Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 18th of May. Our guest this hour is the author of Soul of the Age, a biography of the mind of William Shakespeare. Jonathan Bate is with us, professor of Shakespeare and Renaissance Literature at the University of Warwick. He's also taught at Cambridge, Harvard, Yale, and UCLA. He is a critic, an award-winning biographer, and a broadcaster, and author of several books on Shakespeare, including The Genius of Shakespeare, and another book, a biography of the 19th century peasant poet John Clare. He is principal editor of the Modern Libraries and Royal Shakespeare Company's William Shakespeare Complete Works. He lives in a village, I love to imagine this, near Shakespeare's Stratford-upon-Avon home. And he says that the book is intended as an intellectual biography of the man in the context of the mindset into which he was born and out of which his works were created. He said he has followed his own example and divided Shakespeare's life into seven ages. I like to think that Shakespeare would have adopted a similar procedure if he had been commissioned to write his own biography. And so I thought that we would start, as he starts his book, with those seven stages, the very famous speech from As You Like It. We would start and put our show in the same kind of context, and then we will be speaking with Professor Jonathan Bate. This is Kevin Kline.
All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. First the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. Then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like snail, unwillingly to school. And then the lover, sighing like furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress' eyebrow. Then the soldier, full of strange oaths, bearded like the pard, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation, even in the cannon's mouth. Then the justice, in fair round belly, with good capon lined, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances. So he plays his part. Sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice, turning again toward childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all, that ends this strange, eventful history. His second childishness, and mere oblivion. Sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste. Sans everything.
Professor Jonathan Bate is with us now to talk about The Soul and the Age of William Shakespeare. Professor Bate, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a great pleasure, Kathleen. Yeah. Great to talk to you.
Yeah. Well, what a piece of writing that one is, isn't it? I love the fact that that's how your book is organized.
Well, it was a difficult one to find a structure for this book.
Yes.
Because I didn't want to just, you know, sort of do the straight story. Shakespeare was born, he went to London, became an actor, and then retired to Stratford, because there have been so many biographies like that before. And I really wanted to sort of think about the sort of deep structure of his life. And I spent ages working on it and couldn't find a structure. But then it hit me. He's given me the structure himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was a wonderful way to put the book together. What about, you know, it's really interesting to me that you've spent so much time and devoted your life to studying this man and his mind. I like what you wrote in the intro here, that Ralph Waldo Emerson talked about the fact that he possessed a brain so uniquely vast that no one could penetrate it, but he also was the incarnation of a cause, a country, and an age, the representative poet. What about his brain? Is it so vast that it's hard for even you to penetrate it?
It certainly is. I mean, you know, I've been teaching and writing about Shakespeare for 30 years or more now, and still, every time I see or read one of the plays, I see new things I haven't noticed before. So, you know, there's never going to be an end to new things to say about Shakespeare. And I guess that's, you know, why we still carry on going to see him in the theater and reading him, teaching him, writing books about him.
Mm-hmm. Are you particularly fond of that famous speech from As You Like It?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, of course, we need to remember it is a speech by a particular character, Jaques, the melancholy philosopher, a speech in a particular dramatic context. But somehow it does seem to be one of those moments where you really do hear Shakespeare's own voice. The key thing to remember about Shakespeare in comparison with the other great dramatists of his age, there were plenty of them, people like Christopher Marlowe, is that Shakespeare began his career as an actor. And that sense of thinking about our lives, the way we go through our lives, our relationships, as being a series of performances, a series of roles. And there are so many moments in the plays where, you know, Shakespeare compares living to acting, compares the world to a stage. And you always feel those are the moments where he really speaks in his own voice. So that seemed a great one to focus on.
Mm-hmm. It's so dramatic. The end is so dramatic. Oblivion. I mean, tell me about oblivion and Shakespeare's thoughts on this. You can find yourself, after you read that poem, focusing on that and thinking of oblivion, can't you?
Oblivion, death, yeah, that's right. I mean, it's brilliantly structured, actually, that speech, because to begin with, the sixth age, the Pantaloon, the Pantaloon is the old man. He was a comic type in the Commedia dell'arte, the old man with pantaloons, sort of baggy trousers. And then it shifts into the seventh age, sort of second childhood, and you sort of think of senility and the way that, you know, that funny thing that very old people can be like babies. They don't have any teeth. You know, sans teeth, sans eyes, and then sans everything. And somewhere along the way in that seventh age, it goes from extreme infirmity of old age to death itself, to the grave, to oblivion.
You talk about Stratford, 1564, Shakespeare's England, birth and death went cheek by jowl.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we've just down the road from me in Stratford, we have the parish register in Holy Trinity Church, the local church, where every time a child was born or a couple got married or somebody died, the christening, the marriage, the burial were registered. And, of course, you always get a mix in any week. Somebody's going to be born, somebody's going to die. But what happened in the year that Shakespeare was born is that in the second half of that year, the number of deaths recorded in the parish register just absolutely go through the roof. And the reason for that was that there was a plague outbreak. And, you know, plague, it's one of the things I explore a lot in the book. It was a big factor shaping Shakespeare's life. And like once he went to London to work in the theatre, the problem with plague is that it's rather like, you know, kind of people making preparations for swine flu or something. You know, if swine flu comes, they're going to close the theatres. And that's what happened with the bubonic plague in Shakespeare's time. The moment there was plague, in order to prevent the spread of infection, the theatres were closed down. So you can sort of map Shakespeare going to and fro between Stratford and London, partly through the plague records. Mm-hmm. But that sense that, you know, anybody at any time, however wealthy or however poor, however young, however old, could be struck down by plague. It was an ever, ever present threat.
His brother was at some point, wasn't he? Perhaps.
His mother and father had two older children who both died as babies. We don't know if that was because of plague. And then, as you say, many years later, he had a much younger brother, Edmund, very shadowy figure. born when Shakespeare was 16, mm-hmm. and he was the only one member of the family who followed Shakespeare to London, and we have very few records of him, but he did become an actor. I would be almost certain that he would have been Shakespeare's apprentice, actually, in his acting company. And then in 1608, there was one of these big plague outbreaks in London, and Edmund Shakespeare died, and Shakespeare actually paid the church near the theatre at Southwark in London to have a special memorial tolling of the bell in memory of his dead brother.
Mm-hmm.
Edmund Shakespeare, as a fascinating figure, we know so little about him, but it absolutely shows that plague was very close to Shakespeare's own experience.
Right. And you do say that plague was the single most powerful force shaping his life.
Yeah, that's right. As I say, because of this sense that, once he got into the entertainment business, then the question of whether the theatres were open or whether they were closed really sort of shaped his career. So there's a very important moment quite early in his career, 1592, 1593. He's just established himself as a playwright. He's written some of those history plays, All Blood and Battle, and they're tremendously successful. He's really beginning to cut a bit of a figure in the London theatre world. And then all of a sudden, there's a bad plague outbreak. The theatres are closed down. And he thinks, my career's about to take off, but suddenly we don't know what future there is for the theatre. So he does what a number of other writers did. He targeted a wealthy patron, a young man called the Earl of Southampton, and wrote a poem for him. And this was one of the ways that sort of poets made a living in those days, where you really could not make a living out of publishing your work. But you'd write a poem for a patron, and he'd maybe pay you a guinea for it. But he might also take you into his employment as maybe a secretary or a clerk or something. So what happened there was that because the theatre's closed, Shakespeare began to try to make his way as a poet, a non-theatre poet. And he wrote his actually very funny and clever and beautiful poem, Venus and Adonis,
yes.
And then a second poem for the Earl of Southampton. But then the theatre's reopened, and he joined with the other actors in forming a new theatre company. So there was a moment where the cessation, the end of the plague outbreak, brought him back to the theatre. And that's a pattern that's repeated throughout his life.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at the infant portion. Obviously, we don't know a whole lot about his infancy. But the relative absence, there are a few, but there aren't very many babies in his plays.
No, that's right. I mean, in a sense, as a writer of a biography of Shakespeare, where there are gaps in the historical record, even if you find a good structure, as I think I did, you have to play a few little writer's tricks to make it work. And the fact is, we know very little about Shakespeare's earliest years. We have no record, no sort of family diary of what he was like as an infant in his first few years. And there aren't actually very many babies in his plays, which is sort of not surprising because, the old story about not using children and dogs in the theatre, that sense, a baby is always a problem on stage. Do you have a real baby and find it might cry at the wrong time, or do you have a doll? I mean, they would have had dolls in Shakespeare's theatre, but it's difficult to make a doll look realistic. So there aren't many bits in the plays where he talks about babies. There are one or two. There's a lovely sequence with a baby in The Winter's Tale, one of his later plays. So what I did with the first section of my book was I thought, well, what about the world into which he was born in 1564? What was the world, both his locality in Stratford, but England more generally, and indeed the world, and the way people looked at the world more generally? What was that like? What sort of world was he born into? What I constantly tried to do in the book was sort of follow the model of Shakespeare's friend, the other dramatist, Ben Jonson, who in this lovely poem he wrote dedicated to Shakespeare, he calls him the soul of the age. And I thought, what a wonderful phrase, the idea that one person can be the soul of an age. And so I thought, first of all, we need to sort of describe what the age is like before we get into the soul of Shakespeare himself.
Mm-hmm. You also talk about, this has kind of stayed with me, little did his parents know. Imagine that, they're off in oblivion, and here they have brought in onto this earth this man who is so wise and who has given us this wisdom for so many hundreds of years. I mean, imagine having a child like that, and you don't even know that's going to be the impact of that child because everybody's dead.
That's right. And what's more, of course, really nobody before Shakespeare had actually made a living, let alone an immortal reputation, out of the theatre. Well, that's not strictly true, of course, because they had in ancient Greece, who sort of Sophocles or somebody. But you know, there, when Shakespeare was born in 1564, there was no theatrical profession. There were no theatre buildings. And poets, they just tended to be sort of hangers-on around the court. You know, there's a real sense in which Shakespeare invented the idea of the professional writer. So, as you say, his parents could have had no conception of what was coming. And indeed, his father, although he was a quite successful businessman for a while and got into local politics in the town, he became the town mayor, although he then ran into financial trouble in his business. But, you know, the evidence is a little bit shaky on this, but it looks as though he may not even have been able to write his own name. Isn't that an extraordinary thought, that the father of Shakespeare could not even write his own name?
Yes, it is. I hope that there's something after this life so everybody knows what happened. It would be terrible for nobody to know what happened, but who knows. I was particularly taken, maybe because I was a former school teacher, but I loved the chapters on his education because it seemed to be so formative. The way he learned Latin, you talk about being incredibly influential in how he wrote his plays and how he wrote his sonnets. It was not as sophisticated as, say, Ben Jonson, but his schooling was really important to his development as an artist, wasn't it?
It was absolutely central. I mean, you know, I did a lot of work on this, looking at the curriculum of the grammar schools of the 16th century. He was lucky in the time he was born because it was a period where lots and lots of free schools for, you know, middle-class, lower-middle-class boys, only boys, not girls. Girls were educated at home. But free schools for boys were being founded, and they had very, very good teachers, you know, mostly educated at Oxford and Cambridge. And it was a really rigorous curriculum. The curriculum consisted almost entirely of Latin, you know, 6 days a week, dawn to dusk. Latin. And I'm sure a lot of the time, you know, he found it a bit boring. I mean, remembering the image in the Seven Ages speech, the unwilling schoolboy creeping to school. But it stood Shakespeare in such good stead because what he learned was how to use language, how to put sentences together in imaginative ways, how to shape language in order to construct an argument. How to find, you know, 50 different ways of saying the same thing. I mean, it's there's all sorts of techniques that he learned in school that you can sort of still see there in the play. All those sort of formal symmetries of language, that was all from the rhetoric that he was taught at school. And indeed, one of the things I suggest in the book is there was a school exercise they did of sort of writing imaginary letters. You know, imagine that you were you know, Hector in the Trojan War, or Aeneas founding the city of Rome or something. Write a letter from the point of view of Hector. That's what the schoolboys had to do, you know, when they were just maybe 10, 11 years old, they'd write those letters in Latin. But doing that, imagining what it's like to be a character out of history or myth, and to sort of imagine their emotions, speak from their point of view. I mean, this is the beginning of the dramatist's art, isn't it?
Sure. Yes, it is. And explain, I don't speak Latin, but you do a very good job of helping us understand this. You talk about, in everyday English, grammar relying heavily on word order. Shakespeare studied Latin subject, verb, object in Latin because you can work out the grammar from the agreement of the word endings. You can vary the word order. Can you tell me how we see this study in his plays, in his sonnets, in all of that?
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, because Latin is what we call an inflected language, so you look at a word and you can see from the word ending whether it's the subject or the object of the sentence. What that means is that you can flip your words around. You can hold the verb right back for the end of the sentence, or you can put the verb at the beginning of the sentence. Or you can put the subject and the object in a different order. You can play with language. And the poets that Shakespeare studied in Latin at school, particularly the Roman poet Ovid, wonderful, sort of very playful poet, absolutely loved just messing around with words, messing around with word order, creating patterns of language, and just making words do things in a fresh way. And of course, that's what poetry is all about. You know, who was it? It was Samuel Taylor Coleridge, the great 19th century poet, who said that, you know, poetry is the best words in the best order. I think that, you know, Shakespeare learning that sort of flexibility of word order from studying Latin sort of gave him the idea of playing with the order of words in his great speeches. And you especially see that in the sonnets. Tomorrow is the 400th anniversary of the publication of Shakespeare's collection of sonnets. And so it's a great time to be thinking about just the extraordinarily imaginative way that he organizes his words.
Oh, I didn't know that. We'll have to have a party tomorrow and read the sonnets.
Yeah, why don't you read a sonnet on air to celebrate?
No, will you do that? No, you can end the show with a sonnet. We'll give you time during the hour to find one.
I could do that. I'll have to leave the phone for a moment to go and pull one down, but I'll do that with pleasure.
Oh, great. Well, we'll let you do it right now. I mean, but we'll read it at the end. We'll return and talk about where he learned history. And welcome phone calls from our wonderful audience as well. Our guest this hour is the author of Soul of the Age, a biography of the mind of William Shakespeare. Jonathan Bate is our guest, professor of Shakespeare and Renaissance Literature at the University of Warwick, and he's a critic, an award-winning biographer and broadcaster, has written several books on Shakespeare, and is principal editor of the Modern Libraries and Royal Shakespeare Company's highly acclaimed William Shakespeare Complete Works. And little did I know, tomorrow the 400th anniversary of the publication of his sonnets. Isn't that something? And so he'll read a sonnet for us as we carry on here. Here's our number again, 800-486-8655. If you would like to send an email, that is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Jonathan Bate is our guest now, professor of Shakespeare and Renaissance Literature at the University of Warwick. And we'll give you time. We'll do the sonnet at the end of the show, Professor Bate. Welcoming phone calls right now. Did you have time to get it?
I've got it. Yeah, the book's in front of me.
So, wonderful. Okay.
While I take the phone calls, I'll think about which one to read.
All right. Great. Thanks. John is next, is our first caller from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Oh, good morning. Amo amas amas amemus ametis amat. Might as well do a declension of amo, amare, and also demitit ignotis artis, because that's basically what Shakespeare did. He set his mind to unknown arts, and that's right from Ovid. And my question is, did Shakespeare consider himself a Catholic or a Protestant, an Anglican, since he lived in the time of great martyrdom for Catholics in England?
That's a tremendously interesting question. There's certain evidence that his mother came from a quite illustrious, quite well-connected, important Catholic family. And his father, the evidence is a bit shaky, but he may well have been a Catholic. Shakespeare himself was very clever, very cunning in not revealing his cards, so to speak. He held his cards close to his chest. So there are passages in his plays that do seem to feel as if they come from the old religion, and indeed there were family relatives who were involved with, you know, the Catholic resistance. There was a distant family relative of his who was actually executed as a Catholic traitor. So there's a lot of Catholic connections there. But then there are other passages in the plays where you get sort of, you know, corrupt bishops and so on, and you sort of think he might be attacking Catholicism. So he was very careful not to offend anybody. And the external evidence just isn't there that definitely says whether or not he was a Catholic or a Protestant. But what I think we can certainly say is that the great conflict of ideas, the conflict of faith brought about by the Reformation, the religious Reformation, is one of the sort of crucial forces in his plays. You know, Shakespeare, in the end, isn't about preaching a particular point of view. What he loves is the debate, the argument, the sense there's two sides to an argument. So, I mean, just like really famous example in Hamlet, of a ghost of old Hamlet, you remember, he's been killed. He comes from purgatory. He's very explicit about that. And purgatory is a Catholic idea. The Protestant Reformation abolished purgatory. And yet Hamlet himself, the son, he goes to university at Wittenberg, which for Shakespeare's audience was synonymous with Protestantism because it was where Martin Luther began the Reformation. So it's as if the battle between, or the transition between Catholicism and Protestantism is actually dramatized there in the figure of old Hamlet and young Hamlet.
You talk about the Reformation in your book as being, how do you describe it, the second great shadow cast across the moment of Shakespeare's infancy.
Absolutely right. Plague was one, but the Reformation and just the huge change in both religious customs and also, you know, the way that people looked at the world, it was a crucial thing. Remember, you know, he's born 1564. That's early in the reign of Queen Elizabeth, which means, you know, in his parents' time, there's been, you know, the terrible time of the extreme Protestantism of the boy King Edward's reign, when Catholics were burnt at the stake, and then the Catholic Counter-Reformation of Bloody Queen Mary's reign, where Protestants are burnt at the stake. And, you know, Queen Elizabeth very cleverly manages to sort of balance the opposing forces. But it's a tough world he was born into, a world of spies and informers and anxieties about treason and heresy.
Yeah. Thank you very much, John, for the call. A final word, maybe not a final word. I don't know where we'll go the next 20 minutes. But do you think it's important for us to learn Latin now? Do you know, you must know Latin from studying Shakespeare, but should we all know it?
I don't know if we should say, should we all know it? But it's a fantastic discipline for the mind.
Oh.
You know, there's been some great research done on, there was a school in quite a tough area of New York, I think it was in the Bronx, where they decided to reintroduce Latin for the kids, and it had fantastic results. It's difficult, but it's a superb mental discipline, and it gives you that sort of facility in language. I mean, another thing about Shakespeare's time, of course, it's a time where there's a huge expansion in the range of the English language is taking place. I mean, mm-hmm. So many new words are coming into being.
Let's go to Robert next from Stevens Point. Hello, Robert.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I was wondering if the guest thinks that Shakespeare could only have thrived in the Elizabethan period that he lived in, or if he had lived, say, 50 years earlier during, say, around the time of Henry VIII, or 50 years later during the Cromwellian period, if he could have been just as effective as he was in the Elizabethan era.
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I'm sure the answer to that is no. That it was this sort of chance coming together of the man and the age which made him what he was. 50 years earlier, in the time of Henry VIII, there was no professional theatre for him in which he could express his art. He could maybe have been a court poet, but he couldn't have spoken both to the court and to the people the way that he did once theatre buildings came along and just a single penny was charged for the audience to go to the theatres. And then, of course, in the Cromwellian era, the theatres were closed down. The Puritans didn't like theatre. They didn't like play acting. They thought theatre was dangerous. So in 1642, just as Oliver Cromwell begins to come to power, the theatres are closed down for a 20-year period. But it's precisely this thing about the Elizabethan moment, we might call it, the moment where so many aspects of the modern world are really coming into being. I mean, the religious reformation, the translation of the classics, you know, this is a great period where the Bible is translated into English for the first time. The first voyages, you know, the first voyages to America. There's a whole sense of new worlds opening up, and Shakespeare's kind of tapping into all of this. And so it's a very, very special moment. And the fact is, there's a dozen other very fine dramatists and other great poets, like the great poet John Donne, in his lifetime. 50 years earlier, 50 years later, far fewer great writers and certainly no great dramatists.
Huh, born at the right time. Where did he learn history, particularly Roman history?
Yeah, I mean, he'd have learned some Roman history in school. You know, they would have studied Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars and so on. But his important breakthrough that led him to write his English history plays, which I suggest in the book have really been sort of formative of ideas of what English history and English national identity is about. He would have read them after he left school, when he was in his early 20s, when a big, fat history book called Holinshed's Chronicles, which sort of gathered together the stories of all the English kings going back to medieval times. So that was published in 1587 and provided Shakespeare with his source material for all his English history plays. And then a little bit later, he had another lucky break, because a school friend of his, a man called Richard Field, who, like Shakespeare, went to Stratford Grammar School and then went to London, Field became a printer, and he printed an English translation of a great collection of classical histories and biographies, Plutarch's Lives of the Noble Grecians and Romans. Field, as I say, was Shakespeare's school friend, and I'm sure he would have given Shakespeare, either for free or at a discount, a copy of the English translation of Plutarch's Lives. And that was where Shakespeare got the story for Julius Caesar, Antony and Cleopatra, Coriolanus. And those are actually plays where you can kind of see him writing with the history book open on his page, the page open on his desk as he writes. That a lot of passages in plays like Antony and Cleopatra are very, very close to the original in Plutarch, or Plutarch translated into English.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Robert, so much for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join us. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, that's talk@wpr.org. And we do have an email. I'm wondering if Shakespeare was ever commissioned by the Crown to serve as the court poet playwright, as Mozart was for writing operas for the king.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. But this is how it worked. I was saying a moment ago that the Puritans were the people who didn't like theatre, and the Puritans actually kind of dominated the city of London, which is one of the reasons why the theatres had to be kept away from the city centre. The theatres were across the River Thames, on the south bank of the River Thames, which was a rather rough part of town. It was where you went for theatre, bear baiting, and brothels. But the actors had some very strong allies in the court. The Lord Chamberlain, who was the court official in charge of court entertainments, was the patron of Shakespeare's acting company. And they protected the players from the city Puritans. And the reason for that, of course, was that whenever there was a royal festival occasion, maybe Christmas, or a royal wedding, or an important diplomatic visit, then the actors would have to put on a special performance, so they would go across to the great banqueting hall in Whitehall and perform in front of the Queen. There's a wonderful letter that survives that tells us about one occasion where, at rather short notice, the Lord Chamberlain sort of came to find Shakespeare and his actors, and said, "We need a play tonight. What have you got on the stocks?" And they sort of showed the Lord Chamberlain a list, and they said, "Well, the Queen's seen all these quite recently." And then they said, "Well, what about Love's Labour's Lost? She hasn't seen that for a good few years." And they said, "Okay, we'll do Love's Labour's Lost." And literally in a few hours, they had to remember all the lines and get out the costumes to put on Love's Labour's Lost. Then what happened when, after Queen Elizabeth died, halfway through Shakespeare's career, 1603, the old Queen finally dies, and King James, King of Scotland, comes down, and he becomes King of England as well as Scotland. And one of the first things he does is he takes Shakespeare's acting company under his direct patronage. They become the King's men. And Shakespeare continues to write plays for the court, and he sort of thinks to himself, James was quite an intellectual king, so Shakespeare thinks to himself, well, what sort of things is King James interested in? And he finds out that King James, the Scottish king, had written a treatise about witchcraft. So what does Shakespeare do? He writes Macbeth, a play about a Scottish king and about witchcraft. Or he finds out King James is very interested in the project of unifying the separate nations of the British Isles, England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, into a new Great Britain. So he goes back to the ancient history of Britain and writes King Lear, which is a play about the unification and division of the kingdoms. He's really plugging into the king's interests.
I'm just thinking again about putting those plays together in 2 hours when they haven't performed them for years. They must have placed much more emphasis on memorization of wonderful literature than we do now.
Memories must have been astonishing because even in the regular run of things, you know, they put on plays six days a week, and it was a different play each day.
Goodness.
And they didn't get much rehearsal time. You know, if you talk to modern actors, and you know, they'll have maybe 4 weeks, even 6 or 8 weeks, rehearsing the play and, you know, exploring the character and, you know, sort of getting inside the character. It wasn't like that in Shakespeare's time. He'd write a new play, go out to the tavern with the actors and read through the play himself, reading all the parts, then hand out the parts to the actors. They weren't given a full script. They were only given their own part, the character's own part. They'd have to go off and learn that, and they'd come back a few days later. There'd be one rehearsal in the morning, and the show would be on in the afternoon.
Ah, unbelievable. Ross is next from Door County. Hi, Ross.
Hi, I'm Nick.
Fine, how are you?
Good. I just wanted to ask your guest his thoughts on how Shakespeare's son, Hamnet, how his death may have influenced him as a man and as an author.
Yeah, you've got great callers. These questions
yes,
are all so brilliant.
I know, we do, don't we? Thank you.
yeah, Shakespeare's only son, name of Hamnet, sometimes spelled Hamlet, one of a pair of twins. Shakespeare, his first child is the daughter Susanna, and then he has twins, Judith and Hamnet. But when Hamnet is just 11, he dies. Terrible thing for anybody, for a child to die. But at that time, where the question of inheritance and the idea of the son as your heir, to have only one son and for him to die would be absolutely devastating. That was in 1596. The problem, of course, with trying to map the events of Shakespeare's life onto his work is that, you know, he's not writing autobiography. He is writing plays. And so the relationship between the life and the work, it's always a little bit indirect. But there is a very beautiful speech in a play he wrote at exactly the time of Hamlet's death, one of the now lesser-known plays, a play called King John, where a mother called Queen Constance, her son dies, she has this very beautiful speech about grief. Grief, she says, fills up the room of my absent child. Wonderful image. Sort of imagine, you know, going into the bedroom of a child who's died, and the room is just filled with grief. And that could be Shakespeare's response to Hamlet's death. Mm-hmm. And I think he was very good at, as it were, looking through other people's eyes. And I've got a pretty strong feeling that when about four years after this, he wrote Twelfth Night, which is a play about twins, and it begins, you remember, with Viola, who's been shipwrecked. She imagines her brother Sebastian is dead, and there's a lot of melancholy. It's a comedy, Twelfth Night, but there's a lot of melancholy and the sort of sense of what it's like to be a girl whose twin brother is dead. There's a lot of that feeling in the play, and you kind of think that's one he wrote for Judith, the surviving twin, because goodness, it must have been hard for her as one of a twin to have seen her brother die.
You'd have to be, to use your phrase, quite brilliant at looking through other people's eyes to be able to create what he created, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what drama is all about, and the greatness of any dramatist comes from that ability to get inside not just one character but all the characters in the play, and to sort of keep all the different viewpoints open, keep them all going, keep the debate going.
Right. Thank you, Ross, so much for your call. We go to Peter from Stoughton next. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. You answered my question in part a few minutes ago when you were discussing King James. I was generally wondering what was the extent of Shakespeare's celebrity, for the lack of a better word, at the height of his career. Was it just a regional thing, or was it a word-of-mouth sort of situation where something would occur here and someone would talk about it there and it would be spread? Or how did things like that work with him?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question again, because he was certainly very much admired in the theater world. I mean, we can just tell from things that other writers say about him and the frequency with which other writers start quoting from him. Other writers are forever sort of, you know, quoting Romeo and Juliet and Hamlet and so on. So that's a sure sign how successful those plays were. But in the end, the plays were owned by the acting company. And indeed, often when the plays were advertised, you know, it was the acting company and the title of the play rather than the name of the dramatist that was the big drawing factor. And in a way, I think that the bigger celebrity was Shakespeare's lead actor, who was his friend Richard Burbage, the great tragic actor of the time. And Burbage, you know, he really was like a Hollywood star. I mean, it's actually why that movie Shakespeare in Love, you know, it makes a lot up and it's got some anachronisms, but it's actually a tremendously smart movie because it really gets the sense of the way in which the theatre world then was like the Hollywood world now. You've got the money men, you've got the writer up against the deadline, and then you have the big stars, and Burbage was the big star. But there's no doubt that Shakespeare was tremendously admired, although, curiously, towards the end of his career, there's a little bit of a change of fashion. Other dramatists come on experimenting with new styles, and you get a little bit of a sense towards the end of his career that people think, you know, there are some new kids on the block. So when Shakespeare died in 1616, you know, you and I would have thought he'd surely have a big kind of a sort of national funeral and a burial in Westminster Abbey. In London, but that didn't happen. In fact, another dramatist, a much younger dramatist called Francis Beaumont, died that year and did have the big funeral and the burial beside old Geoffrey Chaucer in Westminster Abbey, whereas Shakespeare died back home in Stratford. There is a monument celebrating his work, obviously put up by his family in Stratford Parish Church, but his death didn't actually make a big impact in London. So there's a little bit of a disappearing act he does towards the end of his career. But certainly when he was at the height of his powers, if you were an aristocrat or the royal court, wanting a special performance put on, then getting Shakespeare and his acting company, that's the first place you'd go.
You write about the fact that he, and tell me more about this, is one dramatist who eventually ended his career out of choice, not by force of circumstance.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I was saying earlier how I suggested he kept his cards close to his chest, so we can't be sure whether he was a Catholic or a Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at all the other dramatists of the time, an awful lot of them got into trouble over politics or religion one way or another. Very often they would have their plays banned or the theatre closed down, or they'd have to, have to quit town in a hurry for fear of being imprisoned for treason. Some of the other dramatists really lived on the edge. I mean, most notoriously, Shakespeare's contemporary Christopher Marlowe, who seems to have doubled as an espionage agent as well as being a dramatist, and to have also had some very risky religious views and sexual views as well. Shakespeare sort of, I think he kept an eye on what happened to Marlowe, because Marlowe came to a sticky end before the age of 30, stabbed through the eye with a 12-penny dagger in a brawl. Whereas Shakespeare, he was never imprisoned. He never had his plays heavily censored. There's a little bit of moderate censorship that goes on. But there was one moment in his career, and I have a long account of this in the book, because it's a fascinating story, where he really did get a little bit close to danger. And that was towards the end of Queen Elizabeth's reign. Her popularity began to wane, and sort of people thought, you know, there was a war in Ireland, there was a lot of economic problems, and there was quite a lot of discontent in the country. And a nobleman called the Earl of Essex actually attempted a coup d'etat against Queen Elizabeth. And amazingly, his followers went across the River Thames to see Shakespeare's acting company, and they said, could you put on for us a special performance of Richard II? And the actor said, oh, Richard II, that's an old play, you know, we won't get an audience for that. And Essex's men said, well, we'll give you some extra money if you do put it on. And so Richard II was put on. Richard II is a play about deposing a monarch. And then the day after it was put on, Essex's men marched through the streets of London, and it looked for a moment as though there was going to be an attempt to dethrone Queen Elizabeth. The actors were... Essex was arrested, executed for high treason. His right-hand man was the Earl of Southampton, who was Shakespeare's patron. And the actors were actually called in the treason trial, but they managed to sort of wiggle out of it. They said, oh, look, we didn't know that this play would be offensive. We were just given the extra money to put it on. And they got away with it. It's a complicated story. But that is a moment where, if things had gone just a little bit differently, Shakespeare could have found himself locked in the Tower or even executed.
That's a fascinating story. Well, we have a sonnet coming up, and we'll hear that and take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking with the author of Soul of Shakespeare, a biography of the mind of William Shakespeare. Our guest is Jonathan Bate. Professor Bate is a professor of Shakespeare and Renaissance literature at the University of Warwick, and he is author of a number of other books, The Genius of Shakespeare, and principal editor of the Modern Library and Royal Shakespeare Company's highly acclaimed William Shakespeare Complete Works. Our number is 800-486-8655. Tomorrow, as you heard him say, I wasn't aware of this, is the 400th anniversary of the publication of his sonnets. So he's going to read one of those sonnets. Joining us just miles from where William Shakespeare was born. This is fun. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The author of The Soul of the Age, a biography of the mind of William Shakespeare. Jonathan Bate is with us, and he promised us a sonnet, which he has retrieved from his shelves. And we get to hear a sonnet, right, Jonathan?
Here we go.
Okay, great.
Sonnet number 18. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest, nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee.
All right. Happy publication of the sonnets. It was a perfect choice. Thank you very much.
In the month of May. Fancy that.
In the month of May, too. Oh, great. All right, let's go to, we have time for maybe one or two callers. Becca from Fox Lake, Illinois. Hi, Becca.
Hi. I am just so excited to speak with you, Mr. Bate. I come from a long line of Shakespeare enthusiasts, and I was very interested in hearing what your perception was on the controversy over whether or not Shakespeare as a person existed, or whether he was actually, you know, the man behind the many works that were written in his name. You know, I know Francis Bacon was sometimes theorized to have written it, or even Queen Elizabeth. So I was just curious what you thought about that, and I will take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Becca.
Okay. I knew this one was coming, Becca. It always does. Every time I get into a taxi and speak to the taxi driver, and they say, you know, what do you do, sir? And I say, oh, I'm a Shakespeare scholar. Did he write those plays, or was it someone else, they say? If we look really hard at the evidence, I think we should have no doubt. There are so many people who knew Shakespeare, both in Stratford and in London, in the acting company. We've talked about his friend, the dramatist Ben Jonson, who describes him as the Swan of Avon. Avon is the river going through Stratford. We have his tomb here in Stratford that has on it lines saying that he's a great writer. And above all, we have the publication of his works after his death by his fellow actors, John Hemmings and Henry Condell. They acted with him all those years. They put together the collected plays in what's called the First Folio, the big book of collected works. Nobody in Shakespeare's lifetime or for nearly 200 years after his lifetime ever doubted that the actor-turned-playwright from Stratford, the middle-class boy without a university education, nobody doubted it was him. But then what happened in Victorian times, well over 200 years later, people began to say, you know, how could someone from such a humble origin have written these great plays? And so you began to get these conspiracy theories and this particularly recurring idea, it must have been an aristocrat, or even, as you said, you know, Queen Elizabeth herself who wrote the plays. And you know, some quite distinguished minds have gone down that road. Sigmund Freud, for instance, began to have doubts about Shakespeare's authorship.
Almost out of time. Couple seconds.
Yeah, sorry. Well, but the answer is, you know, like a lot of conspiracy theories, there is nothing in it, I'm afraid. And I think it slightly boils down to snobbery. I love the idea that an ordinary guy from an ordinary background
could
have done it.
I do, too. Jonathan, what a treat it's been to have you as our guest. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Jonathan Bate, the book is Soul of the Age, a biography of the mind of William Shakespeare. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. John Treader on Air Production. We'll be with you tomorrow.